beware and prepare for something spine tingling, something horrifying, pure terror to your eardrums. This is Epic Film Guy's B-Sides.
Welcome, ghouls, ghosts, slashers, maniacs, and all you bloodsuckers out there to a brand new, and I know what you're going to say, you haven't heard this since December of 2018, but yes, a brand new episode of Epic Film Guys B-Sides. That's right. This is the segment on the Epic Film Guys podcast where myself and my co-host, the god of podcasting himself, discuss the dark underbelly of cinema. Horror, if you will. Loisos, it's been a long time, an extremely long time, since we've done one of these episodes for our audience. How you feel about this, man? How you doing? You pumped for this or what?
Justin, I just realized I can't record this podcast. I'm grounded.
What?
I'm grounded. I threw my grandmother down a flight of stairs.
You piece of shit. Listen, it's been a long time coming, but due to the current situation that we're in, ladies and gentlemen, we all need things to entertain us, and we have been trying to get this back off the ground for so long. However, Loisos is just much too important to the regular normal world out there when it is functioning properly that we can barely ever get him in for a normal episode, let alone a B-side. So personally, I just blame you for us not being able to do B-sides.
It's entirely my fault, yes.
So we put out a poll, as we always love to do when we bring this segment back, to you, the masses, the listeners, our epic film fans, to help us decide what film to talk about next. Our last film from December 2018, released on Christmas actually, was Silent Night, Deadly Night. And this time we gave you guys four choices of movies: Fright Night, Cemetery Man, Spookies, and A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. And the man with the claw and fedora and red and green stripes always comes out on top no matter what happens. So Freddy won this time, and we're going to be talking about Freddy's Revenge, which is saucy, one of the most divisive films in the entire franchise, and I would say probably one of the most divisive horror films from the 80s overall. But we want to thank you guys for taking part in the poll. It's always fun. We like letting you guys pick this stuff. It makes it exciting for us because we don't really know what we're going to be talking about until you make the choice for us. So there is somewhat of a stigma that comes along with Freddy's Revenge. A lot of fans hate it. And then it has a small minority of fans that consider it a cult classic. What goes along with that stigma, however, is a really interesting backstory on the film itself. Saucy, would you please elaborate to our audience about that?
Well, A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, was very quickly rushed into production after Wes Craven's original A Nightmare on Elm Street effectively saved the studio from bankruptcy. Do you want to talk a little bit about Wes Craven's involvement with this film, Justin?
Well, you mean the lack thereof entirely?
Correct.
yes. Bob Shea from New Line Cinema saw an entryway into a way to make money. Now, keep in mind, they basically put all of their funds up for the original Nightmare on Elm Street and basically made no money off of it. They basically broke even. It was a gigantic hit. But it's not like they walked out with, you know, thousands of dollars falling out of their pockets. They just learned that they had a franchise that they could actually make money with. They could use sequels and try to build their company. And it was basically all they had at their disposal. So Bob Shea basically greenlit a script extremely fast. Didn't really even ask Wes Craven to be involved. I think basically because his perspective on the subject was, this is a one and done. This is not something that I created to be sequelized.
He didn't think the concept could sustain a franchise.
But Bob Shea, as we know him from, you know, over 35 years of New Line Cinema, decided to push ahead with a sequel. And he got a lot of people involved that really didn't necessarily have the same passion for the mythology, for the characters, for what the first film meant to the fans, because it was still fresh and new. I mean, if I remember correctly, the movie was pushed into production within weeks after the box office receipts of the first one. So, I mean, they pushed this ahead very, very quickly. Do I think that Wes Craven not being involved hurts the film in some way? Possibly. But the film was thrown into production and made without his involvement, and the rest is history.
He was replaced by Jack Sholder, who had previously directed the 1981 slasher Alone in the Dark, which was also produced by Robert Shea. Have you seen Alone in the Dark, Justin?
Oh.
I guess
yes,
I have. Of course, who am I asking? I'm asking you.
Yes, I have, and it desperately requires a Blu-ray release. I can't believe that this movie does not have a proper HD release out there available. It's extremely tense. It's very mean-spirited. It has a great cast. It has Lois Soss, one of the most ripped-off slasher movie posters of the 80s. I'm seeing posters made now, today, for modern B movies, independent movies that try to rip off the artwork, thinking no one's going to know that I'm ripping off a poster from the early 80s because no one knows about this movie. But dude, literally, that movie is awesome. I love that shit. So I hope eventually it gets a Blu-ray release, but yes. And I think Sholder is a great candidate for a director. He definitely came from an editing background, so he definitely knows how to direct a movie. He knows where to put the camera and everything like that. So Freddy's Revenge is a very competently made movie.
And of course, the script was written by David Chaskin, who we will talk about in detail later on as we get into the meat of this episode, because not only are we talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, we're also going to be discussing a documentary that came out recently centered around, kind of, sort of, about Nightmare 2, but we'll get to that. So let's talk a little bit about the story, Justin. It takes place several years after the original, centers around young Jesse Walsh, played by Mark Patton, whose family has just moved into what was once the Thompson household. Now, Justin, Nancy Thompson's absence is notable in this film. And you wonder why there was never an attempt made to try to incorporate her into the plot. Do you have any insight on why Heather Langenkamp was not in this film and whether she was even asked to be in the film?
Well, I mean, according to Heather, she was not asked. It wasn't even brought up in any of the production meetings at all. It just seemed like without Wes's involvement, they wanted to go in a completely different direction. And I understand that viewpoint when you look at it on paper, because they're like, okay, we already had a female heroine in the first movie. Let's try something different. It wasn't trying to be another Friday the 13th, where we're going to have another final girl at the end of each movie. Maybe let's try a male character at the center. And they decided to do something different. Now, we will get to a lot of the reasons why we think that may be when we talk about the film a little bit later on. But personally, I think it's an interesting idea, because at the time when you looked at slasher movies and horror films of this genre, it was almost always a female character at the center. Now, there are plenty of other female characters that you see get picked off before the end of the movie while they stand strong and face the villain. But yes, female-centric overall.
That's right. And of course, Heather Langenkamp made her return to the series in the next film, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. But for now, we're focused on Jesse, who struggles with being the new kid on Elm Street. And it's not helped by his horrific nightmares, which are so intense, they leave him screaming bloody murder and absolutely soaked.
That's right.
With sweat.
And
with sweat. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, with sweat. It's not like he came all over himself, unless that's what that was. I mean, I can't tell. I mean, he's glistening quite a bit, so maybe he just had... I'm going there. I shouldn't go there yet. We're not even halfway through the episode. God damn it, Lois. See what I'm doing here? I'm blowing my own fucking wad all over this episode way too early. Premature Freddy ejaculation. I'm sorry. I don't even have the glove down there yet, okay? The claws aren't even... I'll stop now while I'm ahead. Ahead. Oh, I went there again. Well, I've only had one drink, I promise you, ladies and gentlemen. But no, yes, he wakes up in the middle of the night with these terrible nightmares. And I have to say, I think upon watching Mark Patton's performance, which we're going to get into in a few moments, they look like extremely grueling and terrifying nightmares.
Absolutely. You mentioned the sweat. On a previous episode, when we reviewed the Predator franchise, we talked about how Predator 2 is the sweatiest movie ever made. But I think A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 might be the second sweatiest movie ever made. Everyone in this film is just glistening at all times with sweat.
Yes, that is correct. I mean, like, you can spray your actors down with a little bit of a mist on their face, but it looked like they just literally oiled these motherfuckers down like they're about to get in a WWF ring about to battle Hulk Hogan or something. That's how sparkly they are in this movie from sweat. But no, I mean, he's dealing with these nightmares. He's the new kid on the block, which is hard enough. But yet he finds out that he's living in this house where this girl lived in, where she watched her boyfriend across the street get killed. And
that's right.
I got a deep backstory there.
That's right. And in his nightmares, Jesse is haunted by the evil specter of Freddy Krueger, who wants to take control of Jesse's body in order to wreak bloody mayhem. Kill for me, Jesse, he says. Although I don't know why he would need Jesse to kill for him when he was perfectly capable of doing it all on his lonesome in the first installment. I never quite understood that. I've read some fan theories that say this is because Freddy's powers are weakened and diminished since Nancy defeated him in the first film, and thus he needs...
Which is apparently is 5 years prior to the events of this film.
Right. So he would need a human host, but there's nothing in the film that really indicates that to be true. So I think the writers were just taking the franchise wherever they
could and as fast as they possibly could to
right.
get it to theaters. However, it's an interesting fan theory. Maybe they're picking up off of that because that was the whole concept of Freddy versus Jason, that he's no longer scary to the kids on Elm Street. So he has to bring in Jason to kill for him. So they'll be frightened again. Then he'll be more powerful. I mean, it's entirely possible, but nowhere here in this script, in this movie, does it indicate that was ever brought up or thought of.
No, and in fact, Freddy's Revenge seems largely uninterested in staying consistent with the in-universe rules set by the original Nightmare on Elm Street. Because in the original, Freddy Krueger always kills people in their dreams.
Always.
That was the entire conceit of the original film, and that's pretty much thrown into the garbage can here.
Entirely. I don't recall, before we get into the meat of this thing, I don't recall one single physical death occurring in a dream sequence in this movie. Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, I've watched it a lot, but
right.
I don't
yeah.
recall. There's not one single death in an actual dream. Overall, what this movie is trying to be, I think, is a possession movie.
Yeah.
Freddy is possessing Jesse.
Yeah. And that's
in
why
order
the...
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why the film is often described as kind of the black sheep of the franchise, because they hadn't yet adopted the formula that the later sequels did, which is, you know, the imaginative dream sequences that take place in the dream world.
Well, you have to think of it. You have to think of this logically, though. I mean, when this film came out, the slasher genre, when the first Nightmare, I should say, came out, the slasher genre had already kind of went into the dumpster. It already kind of died off a little bit. And the first Nightmare completely reinvigorated it, but it was the only film of its type out there. It was completely original, revolutionary, if you will, and legendary. Yes, I'm going to go there. It is one of the best horror films ever fucking made. But at the time that it was made, I don't think New Line or anyone involved other than Wes Craven really understood what they had on their hands. So when they approached a sequel, they weren't thinking in terms of rules or trying to stay true to a movie, because they didn't realize, you know, the legacy that it would have a few years later, or 20 years later, or 35 years later, or anything like that. It was just, this was a movie, it was financially successful, we need to make a sequel to it to keep building on this, and they just went with what they had.
Right. So that's kind of the main idea of the movie. I want to get into performances, Justin, if you don't mind.
Sure, certainly. So there's a lot of characters to run through, but there's a few central characters that really hold this film together. And that's the thing that I want to come out of the gate with on this. A lot of people hate on this movie. A lot of people have shit on it over the years. And
dude, its reputation, like way before I ever even saw the movie, I would see this constantly on like worst horror films of all time list, like most ridiculous sequences in horror film history list. Like there was a top 10 list that I distinctly remember seeing, and they showed the clip of the parakeet scene in the film, which we'll get to, I'm sure, at some point. But out of context and just watching that scene, I swore I would never watch this movie because I'd seen the original by that point. But seeing the parakeet scene out of context, I said to myself, like, this is a mockery of the original film and I'll never watch it.
So my question is then, so to throw it at you right on the spot, do you recall the first time you watched Nightmare 2?
Well, it must have been several years ago. I think 3 years ago is when I watched the entire series through for the first time. I'd only ever seen the original. And those of you who have been with us since then may recall that I posted kind of my reviews on the Epic Film Guys page as I watched through them. And I think at the time I rated Nightmare 2 a 2.5 out of 5. I think I remember that correctly. And I may have underrated this movie because I've since watched it several times.
It sounds fucking like it. Oh my God. Now, there is no other better way to watch this movie than how we watched it last fall at the best place in the entire world, heaven, in my mind, the Mahoning Drive-In Theater in Lehigh, Pennsylvania at Freddy Fest. We got to watch A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge on 35mm with like-minded fans, amazing people, Freddy himself. I mean, it was an amazing experience. It was a beautiful print that they had. So I've made you watch this movie on occasion, a few times, I think, since you watched it the first time. You'd be overboard, hammered, drinking fucking liquor, the alcoholic that you are. I want to watch a horror movie. And I'd put it in, and we would just randomly watch the movie. So you've seen it a few times. And I just figured I would ask you. My first time seeing it was not on VHS like most horror fans. So yes, shame me if you want. Lambaste me on social media. Call me a fake horror fan, if you will. But the first time I ever watched it was when I bought the original Nightmare on Elm Street DVD box set. I know all you motherfuckers remember it because it's fucking beautiful. And that was the first time that I had ever seen it. And I just watched through the films and I realized that I had never seen that one. And over the years, it has kind of become a comfort food flick for me. And I mentioned that a lot on the show. It's a movie that I watch late at night after a couple of drinks. Cinematic junk food, if you will. But we're going to get into performances now. Lois House, I know you had a lot to say about this, in particular, especially Mark Patton as Jesse Walsh.
So I think Mark Patton is a pretty exceptional actor. In this film, particularly during his dramatic scenes, he just exudes this vulnerability and this sensitivity that endear you to his character. And you genuinely believe that he's terrified of the darkness kind of manifesting inside of him. I also think he exhibits great chemistry with his co-star slash love interest, Lisa, played by Kim Myers, who, you know, we all know she bears a striking resemblance to a certain actress.
That's why she was cast, because she looked like fucking Meryl Streep. And she's very beautiful in a very old-fashioned type of way, very girl next door. But I think she is another standout in the film. Their chemistry is really at the core of this movie, what makes it one of the better sequels. I mean, when you look at it, there's a great relationship there and it builds very naturally. And it's because of their great chemistry that they have.
Absolutely. And she's kind of the girlfriend that we all wish that we had, the kind of unwaveringly supportive, you know,
how great is that? She cares so much about this dude and they haven't even banged yet. You know what I mean? Like they've barely had any kind of relations.
And she just cares. Yeah,
exactly. And literally, like, but here's the thing, though. She's not written as a cliche, though. She's written as a very caring, understanding female character. And
at a certain point in the film, when Freddy has succeeded in taking over Jesse's body, she kind of becomes our main character for a little bit, a capable and resourceful final girl in her own right.
I mean, Saucy, let's face it, she's the hero of the story. When it comes down to it at the end of the film, she's the one that kind of saves the day, but
with the power of love.
Yes. With the power, a kiss That's right. Well, that's going old school and very, very simplistic, if you will. But however it works. But my point is I love how she's not like the cliche 80s girl, which I love, but she's not in this movie. She's actually written extremely well for all the mistakes that you know, Chaskin makes in his script. I think that the Lisa character is not one of them.
And what are your opinions on Mark Patton as an actor, his performance in this film?
Oh, man. Honestly, I've always thought he is one of the standout actors, and I'm gonna give it to you straight. I'm gonna get some heat for this. Personally, I think that his performance as Jesse in Nightmare 2 is maybe above and beyond what Heather did in the first Nightmare. I mean, I love Heather in the first Nightmare. I personally prefer her performance in Dream Warriors to her performance in Nightmare 1. But I really just think that I feel for Jesse in part two, and he really exudes this terror that he's going through. Like, you could see that something's really bothering him. He almost plays it like he's a drug addict who can't get clean. And that's kind of how he's the sweating. And, you know, even though his father asks him, all right, two questions, you know, what are you taking and where did you get it from? He's not on anything except for his nightmares. And I just, again, shoot me the hate if you want to, but I just think Mark Patton at the time was an extremely distinguished actor who really had a lot going for him. And I mean, when we get to the discussion about the documentary, we'll talk about a lot of the things that happened to kind of basically put a roadblock in front of him in respect to that. But I love him in this movie. I think he's brilliant.
Absolutely. And we can't go any further in this review without talking about Freddy himself. Robert Englund returns to the character. And again, this is one of my favorite performances that Robert Englund gives as Freddy in the entire franchise. There's a fantastic buildup to Freddy himself. When Jesse first encounters him in the foyer, the film kind of takes its time in showing us Freddy's face. There's an excellent use of lighting and shadow kind of obscuring him. And then we get his classic line, like, "You've got the body, I've got the brain." And then Freddy peels back a scalp and reveals this like oozing, pulsating brain. And it's just like, it's pure nightmare fuel. I love it.
Yeah, it is. And it is exactly that thing that made Freddy the horror icon of the 80s that terrified audiences. I mean, people, it was date night like crazy whenever a new Nightmare movie would come out, and people went because Freddy was the brand new modern Dracula or Frankenstein. Like, he terrified audiences. People were fucking terrified and scared. And
he was still scary at this point in the franchise. Like, later he becomes a parody of himself, but here he's still terrifying.
The pop culture aspect of the character didn't come in until Dream Warriors. So we are still in scary Freddy territory. And I have to go out and talk about, you know, my love of the look and feel of Freddy in this film. Now, the original makeup job was done by David Miller in the first Nightmare film, which he based the idea of the makeup on basically when he was sitting around eating pizza and playing around with cheese and pepperoni. Here comes in Kevin Yeager, who went on to do, you know, makeup on the Nightmare series a few times. And
he designed the Crypt Keeper, right?
Exactly. He did. And he's an amazing makeup artist. And when he came in, again, another one of my favorite things about this movie is the makeup, and it's one of my favorites, if not my favorite, visual interpretations of Freddy Krueger ever put to screen. He gave him like a witch hook nose. He didn't really know what he was doing with the makeup, so he kind of just went for it, and it looks extremely demonic. He gave him the red contacts, the deep red contacts. So he's got, you know, he talked Bob Shay into that, so he's got these deep red eyes, and I just love it. Everything about his version of the character in this film.
And you see some like exposed bone too, like almost like the skin is like just completely melted off.
Yeah,
his skull.
He has really high cheekbones, which adds another witch like element, which makes his jawline even sharper. So his, you know, elongates the bottom level of his face and his chin, which makes him look more like a witch, which again, when I look at each makeup from each one of the Nightmare films on paper, this is probably my number one, to be completely honest with you. It's the one that the burns really are. It just looks like he's scarred rather than burned overall. But I just love how he looks in this film. And we got to get to the fact that Robert is just in top fucking form in this movie. I mean, him as Freddy in this movie, he tries to build on what he did in the first movie. Now, I think on paper, there's not as much for him to do as there was in the first movie.
He has relatively very little screen time in this one.
That's right. But he brings it. And what I love about the backstory on this movie, which we didn't really get into when we opened the episode, is that originally, because the first one was such a big hit, Bob Shea was like, why do we need Robert Englund to be Freddy in this thing? Because Robert obviously got wise to the fact that the movie was making money and wanted more money out of the second movie. And they said, nope. So Jack Shoulder has gone on record. This is an amazing story. It's a funny story where he said, you know, the first couple of days of filming, they had a stuntman in Freddy makeup and he was basically lumbering around like fucking Frankenstein. Any fan that's watched the Never Sleep Again documentary has heard this, but it makes me laugh every single time. And then he basically convinced Bob Shea, like, no, listen, we fucking need Robert. He's the character. He created this thing with Wes Craven. He is this entity that you need. He's your horror icon. And you see it in spades in this movie. Say what you will about the fact that Freddy doesn't play by Craven's rules in this film. You're all my children now is so fucking iconic and so goosebump tingling that you gotta love everything he does in the movie.
Now, we talked about the makeup, but I have to say the special effects overall in this movie are, I have to say, pretty top notch. I have to take a second to commend the effects work on this film. There's a scene later on in which Freddy literally bursts out of Jesse's chest. It just, again, pure nightmare fuel. It impresses me each time. These effects were handled by Mark Sjostrom, who also did the makeup effects for Men in Black and Dick Tracy. That's one of my favorite scenes in the entire franchise, too. What do you think about overall the way the movie looks and the special effects?
When you see Freddy bursting through Jesse's chest, I mean, they were definitely taking note. American Werewolf had already come out, and I think they were trying to really push through what they could do with special effects and makeup and prosthetics. And it shows they were trying to do a transformation scene a little bit more over the top, but within budget. And I love that. I still think to this day, you know, when I was watching it recently to prep for this episode, my daughter had never seen the film. My wife had never seen the film and they loved that scene. They thought it was fucking brilliant. And I still, to this day, that's the scene that for me, really hits home. I mean, because again, this film isn't really as much about dreams as it is about possession. And a lot of fans think it's a bastardization because of that. But you have to think of it within the context of when it was made and what the studio was trying to create. And you kind of have to think it within those terms, if you will. But the makeup, the special effects, for what the budget was, I mean, if I remember correctly, Saucy, the budget was $3 million. And this movie went on to gross over $30 million.
Cha-ching.
So, I mean, listen, back in the day when you did a movie like that and you made that much money, but you just have to think, like, that number alone just proves how profitable this franchise was and that basically you could put anything with Freddy in it onto the screen and people were going to come out in droves for it and literally pack the theater houses. And I think the cast overall is fantastic. I mean, literally everyone, even Marshall Bell as Coach Schneider, sitting there chewing his gum.
I hate that. There's nothing in this movie as terrifying as him just smacking on that gum with his mouth open. It's physically repulsive to me every time he's on screen smacking that gum.
Robert Russler as Ron Grady.
The most handsomest dude alive.
Total fucking 80s heartthrob in this thing. You picked the most handsome dude. He literally had just gotten done with Weird Science, which we all know and love him as a totally deplorable character. But here you get something very similar. He's the bad boy in class. And it's a very weird relationship between him and Jesse.
Are they friends? Do they hate each other? Are they lovers?
It's a very awkward relationship because he starts off as like busting his balls. And then when Jesse asks him, you got some kind of problem with me, Grady? He's like, no, not really, bro. So, like, why is he fucking with him?
There's a scene later on, and I found this to be bizarre. I really only just noticed it the last time I watched it. There's a scene in the lunchroom, in the canteen, where Grady and Jesse are sitting together at lunch, And Grady says, you know, do you want to come over and, you know, we'll do something this weekend, get a pizza or something?
Yeah, get a pizza and hang out.
Yeah. And then Jesse kind of refuses or doesn't say anything. And then Grady's girlfriend, I believe it's supposed to be Grady's girlfriend, or comes over, or at least like a girl who's interested in him.
Or a chick that wants to suck him off or something.
Sure. But she comes over and says, like, hey, what are you doing this weekend? Do you want to do something? He's like, oh, I can't. I'm grounded. I threw my grandmother down a flight of stairs. was that improvised? What was that?
So honestly, I wish I knew. It's one of the greatest lines in horror history, regardless. But that's supposed to be funny.
Yeah,
and it is funny.
But that's such an odd moment, because he's reaching out to Jesse and saying, like, oh, well, I'm here as a friend if you need me. And then this girl comes over and is, you know, getting fresh with him, and he basically completely blows her off. So that's an interesting scene. So I have no idea really what their relationship is supposed to be. All I know is that he's very funny in the role. And again, when his death scene comes, it's very intense, and his performance is extremely credible in that scene.
It is great. We know that he, on the record, was unhappy with his death scene because he really expected to have like a great prosthetic work done up on his chest and everything, and it was kind of a last minute type of thing. But overall, what we're getting at here, because we're babbling on, is that all of the center characters in the film are extremely likable for the most part, and extremely well acted and portrayed. I think that's what really makes the movie what it is. Now, the script itself, we're going to be getting into now, and a lot more about the stigma that comes along with the film. But I think what the film brings is very good characters, very well acted characters, and, you know, people you really want to root for and care about. I think the Jesse character is hard to swallow for a lot of people, especially, you know, traditional male viewers, because of the fact that he's more feminine, and you're seeing him,
Justin,
act out in a way.
Justin, let's not beat around the bush here. This is one of the gayest films I've ever seen in my entire life.
Okay.
And I've seen both Mamma Mia films. Can you imagine a world immune to all forms of cancer?
Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come for our fourth annual live stream for the cure.
And this year, we need your help more than ever.
Please join us May 27th through May 31st for 48 hours of live content from guests and podcasts around the world.
We'll be aiming for our most ambitious goal to date as we try to raise $10,000 for the Cancer Research Institute.
Please visit www.livestreamforthecure.com for more information on this year's event and how you can be a part of it. Together, we can make a difference.
On the record, our listeners know, but for those that are new to the show and everything, you can kind of explain your perspective on this, because you come from a background where you yourself are...
I'm a member of the LGBTQ+ community, yes.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's gay in a derogatory sense. I'm not saying, but there, I'll put it my...
That shit's gay as fuck!
Right. I'll put it, well, it is, but not in that way, not in a negative way. So I'll put it mildly, and I'll say that there is a conspicuous amount of like male sexual tension and phallic imagery and just general homoeroticism in this film. Am I correct in saying
no,
this?
No, you're 100% correct in this. And the weird thing about this, though, and I came to terms with this recently as I rewatched it for this discussion, is that when I watched the movie for the first time, I definitely did not pick up on it. I was not aware that this film was on like the top five gayest horror movies ever made list or any of those things, which Mark Patton himself wasn't either. And we'll talk about that when we get to the discussion on his new documentary. But I mean, I just watched it as a regular horror movie and didn't think anything of it. I mean, it was the '80s. So, I mean, if you're seeing some bare dude ass in a movie is like, okay, sure.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Sure.
Well, I mean, there are lots of things, and let's kind of take this time to kind of bandy about some of the film's gayest moments or images or scenes. Just starting from the fact that the hero of the film has a gender neutral name and spends a majority of the film in various states of undress. So this film is not shot with the male gaze at all, because usually in horror films of this era, it's, you know, a chick running around with her tits out getting chased around by the slasher. But in this film, you have a male, again, usually drenched in sweat with his shirt off or in his tidy whities or whatever. So it is very shot with almost like a female gaze, that which you don't see in horror movies, especially of that era. Then you have Jesse and Grady, that lovely scene where they're wrestling and rolling around in the dirt, and we get a lovely shot of Mark Patton's bare ass and a jock strap. Do you want to talk about the dance scene, Justin?
The dance scene.
The infamous. I mean,
it's infamous. Apparently, this dance scene played in gay clubs for, you know, over 30 years as an ongoing thing. People found it very, very intriguing and exciting. And dude, I mean, Risky Business had came out. We all know why it was put in there. And we know that Mark Patton was not comfortable doing the scene, and he held it off until the absolute last minute to do it while they were on set. And then he had an idea for it and he did it, and now he regrets it and he thinks it's like the worst thing ever.
Well,
but it's also when you see what he's doing now with screenings of the film and when he's having public appearances, it's the one thing everyone wants to see him do again, including myself. Like, when I meet him, do you think that I don't want to see him do the dance? I'm going to bring the popper myself and pop it right in front of him.
Like, yeah, because he's twerking his ass against the dresser drawer, and like he places a pop gun toy
near. It's a popper, man. It's an old school, like 1930s wooden toy you could get like at a dollar store. I'm sure if you go to a fucking Cracker Barrel, you know, the restaurant that your grandmother and grandfather go to. I like the Cracker Barrel because they still serve ham. Yeah, if you go there and you find the old school toys they have there, it's just a popper. You put a ball in there and you push the back of it and it pops out. It goes pop. And that's what it is.
Yeah, he like places it near his groin area and he's like stroking it continuously. It's like, did no one on set say, hey, wait a minute.
We're getting ahead of ourselves because, yes, we're always saying we're going to get to it, which we hope we will.
We will.
But the dance scene is I personally love it.
No, me
I've
too.
I've always loved it. I've never been like one that's like, that's so fucking gay. I'm not, you know, that guy. And I've never been that guy that was like, this scene doesn't fit, because he's just a kid. He's just a teenage kid letting loose, man. Letting loose, like, how many times when I was a kid, I still do it now. You know what I mean? Where I'm jamming out in the car, or especially when I was a teenager. I mean, I was in bands at the time, but like when I was even younger than that, I had my hockey stick and I would pretend like I was playing guitar and I would just jam out to music and dance around my room. Like, it's a natural teen thing that you would see. So did I find it overly gay? It's not like he's jacking himself off in front of the camera. You know, he's just doing a very
sexualized dance.
Sexualized awkward dance that doesn't really make much sense. But again,
there are also many other scenes. I mean, there's one point where there's an extremely phallic looking like candle, I think it's supposed to be a candle on Jesse's nightstand that melts at one point, and the dripping wax just looks like uncannily like cum. Do you know what I'm talking about? The green candle on his nightstand.
Yes, Loisos. I'm very, very aware of this. Obviously,
just look at that candle, though.
I mean, we have the entire concept that Coach Schneider, which you know, they mention outright that he likes to go to the gay bars.
Dom's place, the very cheekily named Dom's place.
He goes, you know, Jesse, when he's having one of his episodes and Freddy's trying to take him over, he goes to the gay bar and you get to see Bob Shay with all that leather clad material all over in his spikes serve a beer. And then Coach Schneider's like, nope, I'm pulling you out of here and I'm going to go make you do laps at school.
Yeah, which that was
in itself is very weird and perverted. Like he's going to sexually assault him. I don't know if that was implied or maybe that's just we're looking through it at 2020 eyes because now it would be looked at that way.
Well, because it's set up that he likes to torture Jesse and Grady by making them like run laps and do, you know, plank and stuff.
But he's gay, apparently, and likes to hang out at gay bars, so that means he has a thing for young boys.
Well, and Grady even says at one point, like, he gets his rocks off like this. So you get the sense that he gets, like, some kind of sexual pleasure from it, which is weird. But, like, if I were Jesse and if I saw my gym teacher out in public and he said, come with me, you're doing laps at the school, I'd be like, no.
I'd be like, go fuck yourself, motherfucker. And I just ordered a fucking beer. I'm about to drink this shit and go fucking home. Maybe I'll go fuck the dude in the corner over there. I like what he looks like. You know what I mean? Like, again, but it's a movie, so whatevs.
So then we see Schneider in his office. And then all of a sudden, balls start flying at his face. Like basketballs and tennis balls start like flying off of the shelves.
How that shit is not done on purpose is beyond me.
Then he's dragged into the showers with jump ropes that come alive and, you know, wrap themselves around his hands.
And his ass is fucking whipped.
Yeah, he's
with
stripped.
A fucking towel.
He's stripped naked and then he's whipped in the ass repeatedly with towels.
Whoosh, whoosh.
Which is a great scene for a multitude of reasons. But did no one know?
So we have to open this up now. We have to open this up now.
Because the director, Jack Shoulder, claims that he had no awareness of the subtext.
I didn't know that. I couldn't tell when I was on set that it was anything remotely close to being homosexual. I didn't notice.
That shows a startling lack of awareness on a filmmaker's part, not to look a little closer at what you're shooting.
Or anybody else involved in the production, according to all of them. Again, watch the Never Sleep Again documentary. They all don't seem to understand that when they were making the movie, how fucking gay all of this was. Again, the coach brings back one of his students from a gay club while wearing a leather spiked vest, which was extremely popular in the early 80s in gay clubs, brings him back, makes him do laps, then makes him go shower naked, gets his ass whipped bare by a towel.
Yeah, so many like film scholars and fans of the franchise have spent years dissecting the supposed psychosexual themes of the film, with Freddy often being linked to Jesse's, you know, sexual repression or the fear of, you know, the invasive and deadly AIDS virus and so on. You know, there's literally a line in the film where Jesse says, you know, something is trying to get inside my body. So, like, there is subtext there. And arguably, after a certain point, you could just call it, you know, text. But that brings us to a film that you and I both had the pleasure of watching recently. Justin, do you want to talk about Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street?
Certainly. Well, this is the brand new documentary that came out this last year. It actually debuted and played at a lot of film festivals. And this is Mark Patton's documentary. The only thing I really knew about his experience on Nightmare 2 was what he talked about in Never Sleep Again, which apparently, Loisos, was like the first time he had talked about being in the film for many, 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 many years after he left Hollywood.
No one could even track him down. No one knew where he was.
He was in Mexico, and he had been married, and a lot of things had happened since he was in Nightmare 2. And he decided, you know, he was like, oh, I kind of want to see what's going on. He looked into what the legacy was of Nightmare 2 and realized there was a lot of talk around his performance, the film itself,
a lot of
how
hatred.
It affected horror films. And yes, and it really affected him as a person he didn't even understand why fans were looking at the film this way.
And Justin, not to interrupt, but I remember when I was doing research on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, and again, this was maybe even years before I had seen the film properly all the way through, after just having like seen little clips online. And I read reviews that people would leave on IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, viciously attacking Mark Patton, saying, you know, calling him faggot and just all sorts of horrible things, or like, he's directly responsible for the worst film in the franchise. You know, fuck A Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
I mean, David Chaskin even went on record and blamed him on numerous occasions, numerous interviews, that saying, like, you know,
I didn't put the subtext in there. He made it that way because
he made it that way. I mean, when you look at the script, if they had put a different actor in the role, what he tried to claim was, it wouldn't have been that way. Now, when they cast Mark Patton, they cast the best actor for the role. He was a gay actor that got the role based on him doing the best audition for the part. No one cast him based on what we've heard, what we know, that, you know, on the fact that he was gay or that he was the gayest person for the role or anything like that. Because keep in mind, when you look at the script, he has a female love interest in the film. So no one knew. And what Chaskin always claims is that, well, they cast the wrong person. He's what made all the subtext come out and make it really at the forefront. I don't really necessarily know if I believe that or not. But the key thing is all of this over the years kind of like built up like molten lava, and it exploded. And Mark was sick of hearing about it. After he realized what it was, he wanted to clear his name. He wanted to get to the bottom of this. And that's where Loy Sauce, Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, Mark Patton's documentary, which is one of the most brilliant things I've watched so far this year, Loy Sauce. We watched it together. You got to give me your rundown on what you thought of the documentary.
Well, I thought it was deeply moving, you know, and Mark's story is so powerful because, as you mentioned, he was cast in the role based on his talent alone. But of course, this was in Hollywood in the 80s. There was this stigma around homosexuality during this time of AIDS paranoia and gay panic. And Mark Patton, as a gay man, you know, played this role as sincerely as he could. But due to, again, some of the things we talked about earlier about, you know, some of the homoeroticism of the film, there was a stigma then surrounding him as an actor, and that led him to be seen as being typecast in Hollywood. You know, his agent would say, we have to pass you as straight because no one's going to believe you in a role where you play, you know, a leading man, a straight leading man in Hollywood. You know, there were no gay leading men in Hollywood. So they said, well, we're going to have to either pass you as straight or you're only going to get roles as like the side characters or the sidekicks. And so I guess, you know, he was just so fed up with that he left acting completely and almost, you know, kind of became almost something of a hermit. And it's, the documentary is just about his journey of healing, because for the longest time he was so resentful of Nightmare 2. It was a source of deep, you know, shame for him. And you get to see his coming to terms with it, coming to terms with the fandom that have since come around on the film. Because again, like for the longest time, you would log on and type A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 into Google and see nothing but hate, just hate for the film.
And you have to think of this in terms of being a fan, as a cinephile, as a film critic. The first film, highly considered one of the best horror films ever made. And then you have Nightmare 2. And then you have Dream Warriors, which is considered one of the best horror sequels, one of the best fantasy horror films ever made. So it's stuck
arguably
in between
better than
two.
The first film.
I mean, you have two films surrounding Nightmare 2 that are highly regarded as two of the best of the 80s and two of the best of all fucking time, like on the top 100 list for almost everybody. So,
and then right smack dab in the middle is Nightmare 2.
Exactly. So it's just like squeezed in the middle of those two movies. And it's a highly misunderstood movie. And, you know, Mark just went in, he got the job as an amazing actor, and performed what was on the page and gave it his all. He didn't try to give it, you know, a gay twist. He didn't try to be gay. He didn't try to be straight. He just performed the character as it was written on the screen. And this is where we... Go ahead.
And that's why he had this kind of resentment towards the screenwriter, David Chaskin. Because in interviews that David Chaskin would give about Nightmare 2, he would try to pass off the blame to Mark by denying the intention of ever including any gay subtext and just, you know, squaring the blame entirely on Mark. There's a portion of the documentary where Chaskin's interviewed, and he says, and I'm I might be paraphrasing here, but that the horror of the film would not stem from homoeroticism. You know, people were getting it wrong that it wasn't about homoeroticism, but the horror would come from homophobia, in the sense that, you know, it was kind of tapping into that latent male fear of gayness and femininity, and that would add to the horror, and it would scare men, you know. So
you want me to tell you what I think about that?
What's that?
I think it's fucking bullshit. I think that's like the biggest pile of bullshit I've ever heard, because when you look at it on the page, it's clearly written with all of the homoeroticism in place. I want to know what you're thinking about it, because you come from a different background, you see it from a different viewpoint. But for me, like, for him to say that, like, to backtrack and try to, like, you know, basically he's trying to save his own skin, you know?
Yeah. Well, I agree with you that it's bullshit that he tried to pass the blame on to Mark. It may have been his intention to weave in homosexual themes of the fears of gayness into the film, because I'm not trying to say he's homophobic or anything like that. But again, during the time there was that stigma attached to homosexuality, you know, due to the AIDS crisis and all of that, that he very well could have thought that that would make for truly a terrifying horror subtext. But the film really comes to a head when, you know, you get the sense that just under the surface, there's just this bubbling anger that Mark Patton has towards David Chaskin because of all of this resentment he's built up over the years. And the scene, or the documentary, concludes with this beautiful scene where he kind of confronts Chaskin for the first time in over 30 years. He's able to sit down and kind of ask him these questions and confront him. And it's a little awkward. It's a little uncomfortable because Chaskin is, you know, very defensive at first. But it's so cathartic and it's so emotional because he, I mean, not to give anything away about the movie, but again, it's more about the emotional journey. But he does get that apology that he's been looking for 30 years, over 30 years from David Chaskin. So, I mean, as I said, the movie is the emotional journey of Mark Patton learning to embrace what was once, you know, something he considered shameful. Even the dance, as you mentioned earlier, something that, you know, fans have come around on. And he, when he does public screenings of the film and seminars and things like that, he will do the Nightmare Dance.
He'll do the dance, dude, yeah. Which I need to see in person. I personally missed out on a screening in Syracuse, New York, when he attended and they showed the film on 35mm, and obviously he performed the dance and everything. And I need to see this, you know. I definitely want to meet Mark. He's one of the people from the franchise that I have not yet met. But you know, what bothers me the most is David Chaskin, number one, you know, claiming that the subtext was either there or it wasn't there. And I still, to this day, I mean, I get that Jack Sholder directed the movie with the best intentions and he just directed what was on the page, but it shocks me. It shocks me outright. And I'm seeing this from 2020 eyes, but that nobody realized while they were making this movie that the gay themes were there. I mean, they were plenty there. One of the production designers was gay, but I mean, overall, when you looked at this, how were you not seeing? I mean, he's screaming like a chick and you're shooting it. So how are you not realizing it? I mean, obviously he knew what he was doing. He was portraying it, what was on the page, but Voice House, I can't understand people being on set where like they just that oblivious to it, where they just that focused in on just getting the job done that they weren't focusing on what the product was that they were creating.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know. But that's also part of the beauty of the documentary is it in Mark Patton's journey is that he kind of wears it as a badge of honor now that he's the first male scream queen in horror history.
And goddamn right, he should.
Yeah,
he really should, man.
Absolutely. And he definitely deserves that. And I think the film itself, I mean, so there's a certain moment throughout the film where Mark reveals something about himself, but the film doesn't reveal it until about an hour in. And so you get the sense that the film has tremendous sensitivity to the subject because it's something that Mark Patton says he does not like to reveal during public speakings and seminars and things like that until like he's halfway through or until a certain moment where he chooses to reveal it. And the film does the same thing. And I think that shows a tremendous sensitivity towards, you know, Mark Patton as a person. But ultimately, I mean, the Nightmare on Elm Street fan community is so it's so open, it's so inviting. We actually see a couple of people that we're friends with, Paige Joy and DeAndra Laser, like in the film as cameos, you know, in cosplay and at conventions. And you get the sense that Mark is just so he's finally come around on the film and he enjoys meeting his fans and he's so personable with his fans too. Like he loves getting pictures with the Freddy glove and things like that with fans. So ultimately, this film, it's a love letter to Mark Patton. It's also a love letter to the fans. So if you have a passing interest in the franchise or if you just want to see a great story, I could not recommend Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street more.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite movies of the year so far. Definitely in my top three. And I would love to get Mark on the show to talk about it. Oh my God, it really hit a nerve for me after I watched it because it really broadened the idea that was presented in Never Sleep Again when he kind of came back to talk about this movie so many years later. And he's reflecting on all these things that he kind of let lay dormant for so long. And, you know, you think about how something like this can affect you so many years in the making. And it was the beginning of his career. He took a job. He did a brilliant fucking job. And he didn't realize that it was basically being made fun of all over on social media, on the internet. And then he kind of took control and said, you know what? I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to be part of this. I'm going to live up to it. And I'm going to, you know, be proud of who I am. And now the film has a giant cult following. And again, I was never one, you know, I'm very proud of this, Lois House. I was never one to hate on Nightmare 2. I was never one to sit around and talk shit about it. Again, it was always cinematic comfort food for me. And I prefer it over a lot of the other sequels in the series. I think it's extremely well made. I think Freddy is top notch. Does it follow Wes Craven's rules? No.
No, in fact, it's often frustrating at times because things just happen kind of completely at random. You know, as the movie goes along, Freddy pretty much does whatever he wants. He can like shut windows and lock doors and boil water and make TVs explode using telekinesis, I guess. Like, it's never really explained how he can do these things. Logic is just kind of thrown out the window and it just becomes a series of occurrences. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a fascinating film. I think it's something of a curiosity. Yes, it's the black sheep, but there are fleeting moments in it that I would consider some of the series best. It has brilliant practical effects. I think a great chemistry between Mark Patton and Kim Myers, a genuinely scary performance by Robert Englund. Let's throw a number on.
Throw a number on this. Like for me, out of 10. You know, out of 10, well, you don't have to tell me. I invented the out of 10 here on the Epic Film Guys podcast. It's we never do anything other than that, Loisaw. So thank you for reminding me.
I mentioned earlier because I mentioned that I gave Nightmare Part 2 a 2.5 out of 5. So
I know that small bottle of Jameson that you drank earlier got you really hammered. So you don't have to you don't have to find excuses for yourself. I know how shit faced you are. You know, we're both in quarantine. We're both sitting at our places and, you know, hey, we're going to booze it up and talk about great movies and we hope you guys are enjoying it. But for me, you know, I'm going to give Nightmare 2 a 7 out of 10. I think it's a good movie. I think it's on paper, And you know, when you watch it, it's entertaining. I think that Robert's great as Freddy. I think Mark gives a fantastic performance. I think that the Jesse and Lisa character have a fantastic chemistry. I think they're very well done in the movie. The house is still in there, so you still have that, the mythology of the house and the local town, and you're still there on Elm Street. So a lot, I mean, the main thing that I would tell you that bothers me and pisses me off is that the original Nightmare theme is not present in the film, and you don't hear the original score at all whatsoever, at all. It's not present in the film whatsoever. But otherwise, I mean, they're very inventive with what they have in front of them. They learn from their mistakes in when they, you know, took on the third movie. But overall, when you look at Nightmare 2, it was an experiment. And sometimes experiments work and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're underappreciated and swept under the rug. And sometimes, in the case of this film, you know, 30 years later, we're looking at it in retrospect and saying they don't really know what they had there. And it's extremely special. And I'm glad we're talking about it tonight. And I'm glad that you guys, you fans out there, you epic film fans, picked it for our discussion. But Saucy, what are you going to rate the film?
Well, damn you, Justin. We're going to have the same rating again because I'm going to give Nightmare on Elm Street 2 Freddy's Revenge a 7 out of 10.
See, you're not going to get a belt this time. You're going to get a flying fucking towel to your ass there. But you're going to be whipped that shit till you're fucking raw and you can't walk, motherfucker. That's what you're going to get for defiling that your daddy tonight.
I mean some of the dialogue is pretty awful, and there's a considerable camp factor that keeps it from reaching like the more polished heights of the series, such as, you know, Dream Warriors or New Nightmare. But for all the reasons I mentioned before, Freddy's Revenge, every time I watch it, my fondness for it grows. And this last rewatch after watching Scream Queen gave me a new sense of appreciation for it. And, you know, when a documentary about a film can make the film better in retrospect, then that's the mark of a great documentary. So I'm going to give Scream Queen an 8 out of 10 rating.
Wow.
What about you, Justin?
That's fucking high praise. And I think as far as the documentary is concerned, it's a 9 out of 10 for me. I think you don't see documentaries like this. I mean, it's extremely original. And I've never seen a documentary about an actor being involved with a film, a certain film that basically kind of changed their entire life in that way, where, you know, they left Hollywood and you get to see a lot more about Mark Patton that I didn't really know much about, you know, as far as his personal life, his relationships, why he decided to, you know, go basically hide himself from this franchise and these fans. And that now he's back in the limelight and he's out there with this documentary and he's, you know, a part of the fans, and the fans are embracing him. And this whole film is kind of, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with our current society and our acceptance and what has kind of happened within the LGBTQ community in the past 10 years. But, you know, overall, he's shining. His star is shining. And I'm so happy to see that because he does a brilliant job in the film. Like I said, he was just an actor that took a job, an up and comer, and he did a brilliant job. And for so many years, he was ridiculed for doing nothing than doing his job as an actor. And I've always found his performance to be special in the film. And I think Scream Queen is definitely going to make it onto my top 10 of the year list at the end of the year. I highly recommend it. If you haven't watched it yet, you could rent it on Amazon Prime. Last I checked, I bought my copy on DVD on Amazon Prime. So I would say support the film, buy it on DVD. It was only like $5 more to own the actual disc with cover art, which is a beautiful fucking cover and everything. Just support this film. If you're a huge horror fan, if you're a fan of films in general, it's definitely an intriguing look into another way of how film affects us as fans and as actors involved.
Absolutely. And actually, if you're interested in watching another documentary about an actor coming to terms with his sexuality, I'd recommend Tab Hunter Confidential.
Oh, dude, I love that one. You know, I love that one. We've talked about that one plenty of times.
And then if you're looking for more queer slasher films, I'd recommend Knife Plus Heart, which came out last year from director Yan Gonzalez. But yeah, Justin, we just talked about Nightmare 2 for an hour.
I mean, I could keep going. I mean, again, it's a film that opens up so much conversation. And you notice that, like I said, we saw the film at Freddy Fest at the Mahoning Drive-In Theater in Lehigh Heights in Pennsylvania last fall. And when the film played, it got applause, man. I mean, people were excited. Like, there was this certain vibe in the air, and you realize that the film that people used to make fun of 10 years prior, they're now celebrating and appreciating, which to me, it really warms my heart and makes me happy. And I'm so glad that the fans picked this as our B-side comeback episode. So thanks again, Epic Film fans.
Many more to come.
Many more to come. You heard it from Saucy. So if we don't put them out, blame him again. It's that motherfucker's fault, not mine. But thanks again for listening, guys. During this time that we're going through right now, you know, it's time for us to have fun, be entertained, do what we can to get through so we can get back to a normal time. And what we're going to do is provide you with the best entertainment that we possibly can. We want you to hang out with us. So if there's any recommendations, anything, you know, any input you guys have, we would love to hear it. But until next time, Boy Sauce, tell our listeners where they can find us on social media.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Epic Film Guys. And you can also join in the conversation on our Facebook group, the Hopesters Dumpster, the fan community where we can chat with each other, hang out, talk about movies. Because that's what it's all about.
That is what it's all about. So until next time, for Nick, for that dirty piece of shit hobo laying down next to the dumpster near the bar that's closed right now, I'm Justin.
And I'm Brian.
And we'll see you